Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. I'm your host, Cindy Howes. Hope you're doing okay. Fighting the good fight, keeping it real, Black Lives Matter. Nice to have you here. If you are new to this podcast, welcome. Super awesome to have you listening and hope you enjoy what you're about to hear. And if you like what you hear, you can subscribe by going to any podcast platform, hitting the subscribe button, rate, review. You can also check out all 72-ish episodes at my website, cindyhouse.net. Okay, let's get into Issa Burke. Issa Burke of the Americana folk trio Lula Wiles is an opinionated white lady in America, and I literally cannot get enough of her. The Maine native rebelled at a young age. I think she was under 10 years old. She was rebelling against her parents' folky disposition and devoured as much rock and roll as she could find. Eventually, her parents convinced her to attend Maine Fiddle Camp, where they attended as performers and teachers to campers of all ages. We're talking from babies to grandparents. And what do you know? Issa loved the hell out of Fiddle Camp and met some important friends while she was there, namely Eleanor Buckland and Molly Obomsawin, who, years later, came to form the trio Lula Wiles. Camp was also the first place that Issa saw young people taking on the folk tradition in a modern way. This excited her to no end, thus beginning a lifelong affair with traditional music. In our conversation, Issa talks about the lessons she learned at Maine Fiddle Camp and how they are reflected in her musicality and in her band. It also rooted her in a love of playing music for the sake of feeling good versus playing to sell a lot of records. We get into her lead guitar playing, and I gotta say my favorite part of this interview, and maybe any interview really, are Issa's candid comments about body image issues. She, a while ago, introduced me to the idea of body neutrality and talks about working to cultivate that and the struggle that comes along with trying to figure out how to feel about your body. Like I said, can't get enough of her, love her, would recommend talking to her for an hour at least. Okay, we're going to listen to a song from Lula Wiles. This actually is one of Issa's songs. It's called Shaking As It Turns. And then we'll get to our conversation with Issa Burke of Lula Wiles on Basic Folk.
Is this land yours? Is this land mine? The fault lines crack and the fists they fly. In the heat of the night, I touch the falling sky. It's a story as old as the flag in the yard. The money's too tight and the work's too hard. Baby, do you know just who your enemies are? And the world it sings and the world it burns. I feel the world shaking.
Your parents, Susie Burke, and how do you say your dad's last name?
Surrett.
David Surrett. You have performing parents who started playing together in the mid-80s in Maine, which is where you grew up. So your mom is mainly the singer and guitarist, and your dad also plays along on guitar, mandolin, etc. What do you know about how they met and what their connection was like at first?
Oh, great question. So they met at a bar in Portsmouth, New Hampshire called The Press Room, which is still around, still hosting live music. I mean, obviously not currently hosting live music, but in the non-pandemic sense, they're still around and still at it. They met there. She was playing a gig and he was like, whoa, who is that? And then he went up and talked to her and was like, hey, do you need a mandolin player? And she was like, who is this guy? And then they started playing music together. And then a few years after that, I arrived on the scene.
That's awesome. Do you know how old they were when they met?
She was in her early 30s and he was in his early mid 20s.
Awesome.
So they're about 10 years apart. Okay. Which is great. Cool.
Totally cool. Your dad, I saw, compiled a book of Breton dance tunes from Brittany, which I like. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to pretend I know what I'm talking about, but it sounds like that's the Celtic region of France.
True.
What is the story behind that book and his interest in that kind of fiddle music? And then how do you think putting together something like that affected his musicianship?
That's a cool question. So my dad, so the name Surette is, it comes from Nova Scotia, via France. It doesn't obviously originally come from Nova Scotia, but, his family is, French Canadian. And so I think through that, he kind of got really interested in French Canadian traditional music and then eventually in, French traditional music. And he was already really into Celtic music, like particularly Irish music. And we have some Irish heritage in our family as well. So I think, kind of being able to bring all of that together by studying the music of the Celtic region of France, was a cool thing for him to discover. And he's been to Brittany, at least once. I don't know if, it was more than once, but I think at some point, a long time ago, he got a grant to go study that music in Brittany. Within like the Celtic traditional music scene, I think Breton music is a little bit less popular or lesser known. And so I think he's been really into like being an advocate for that, for that music.
Yeah, I found like the first few pages of it on Google somewhere, and it said that I like knew it was your dad because it said, you know, drawing on page 2 by Issa Burke. And then it connected the dots.
Totally. I have a little side gig of just designing the covers for my dad's tune books.
Does he have a lot?
There's only 2 that I've done the design for. He just released a new one recently, which is French and Italian tunes, that he's notated for mandolin and fiddle, and I designed the cover for that.
Does he just like find these traditional songs and then writes out the music?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he'll transcribe them, and for this new one, he wrote out like the tablature specifically for mandolin, and he's notated stuff specifically for guitar too. A lot of people find tablature easier to read if you play a fretted instrument. So yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what parts of each of your parents' musical styles have influenced your playing the most? Which is like not a big question at all, but go ahead.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think both of my parents have been really influential on me as a musician. One of the big things that I took from both of them is kind of more big picture than, you know, just my specific styles of playing or singing, but they just really raised me in community, in the folk and traditional music community. And so I think I had a really clear understanding of what that was all about from a very young age. And I didn't even really like appreciate it fully until I was like a teenager. When I started meeting more young people who were playing traditional music, and specifically hearing bands like Crooked Still that were kind of making traditional music sound like hip and young and fresh. But I think that, you know, when I went to Berklee College of Music, when I got there, I started seeing all these people who wanted to be professional musicians and they wanted to like be really famous and make a lot of money. And I kind of realized that like I was sort of unique in that I had this understanding of A, music as a vehicle for building community and like playing music just for the experience of playing together, not for performing or making money. And then I also had a sense of like, oh, it's totally possible to have a music career that is like sustainable and can sustain you. And you're not famous at all. You know, you don't have a manager, you don't have a booking agent. You know, my parents have been a total mom and pop shop for a long time. And they, you know, they sent 2 kids to college on that. Like we didn't grow up with a ton of money, but I was never in like dire need. I always had, you know, I always had everything I needed. And so I, you know, I knew that they could do that. And I saw so many people in their community who were able to do that. And I feel like that gave me a really good grounding that set me up well for, you know, what came later.
This is something that I think we're going to talk about a couple of times during this interview. You have said that you rejected folk music. Like, you liked it, but you rejected the notion of that, like, I don't belong in this world. Like, I'm not a part of that because I only see older people playing it.
Yeah.
So it's funny to think, like, you kind of had, like, a reverse rebellion. Like, you were rebellious, like, before you were 10. But you were into, like, rock music when you were younger. Like, you wanted to play rock and roll. I just want to say for the record that you used to play trumpet in school band.
True.
And when you were
People forget.
Yeah, let's take a moment to leave space for the trumpet. Uh-huh. When you were 10, your parents gave you a red, bright red electric guitar. I'm just wondering, like, what it was like when you got that guitar and if it changed your relationship with your parents. Like, did you view them any differently after that? Like, oh, these people understand me. They support me.
Yeah, yeah.
Or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, so they got me the electric guitar. Literally, I can point to two very specific things that made me want to play the electric guitar. One was the movie School of Rock starring Jack Black. And the other was the movie Freaky Friday starring Lindsay Lohan, in which her character is in a band and plays the guitar. There's a scene at the end where she plays a song at her mom's wedding, and that was formative. And so, yeah, they were down. They got me the electric guitar, and my dad started, you know, he would teach me, like, Beatles riffs. I remember learning the riff from Day Tripper. That was, like, one of our early guitar lessons. And I think my parents did a really good job with both me and my sister of, like, encouraging us to be musical, but not, like, not ever forcing or pressuring us. They just really kind of immersed us in music and sort of let us kind of take the lead. And then there were times when they were like, no, like, you really should practice because you decided you wanted to learn this. And you agreed to do this. And part of that means, like, working hard on it. But I think they managed to hit a really good balance. Yeah, so I went nuts for the electric guitar. I remember I played the song What I Like About You in the fifth grade talent show. and then at a certain point, I went to Maine Fiddle Camp and met, you know, some young hip folkies. And I was like, yo, folk music is cool now. And then at a certain point, I circled back to the electric guitar. And now I feel like it's all, you know, it's all coming together.
Totally. So you say that singing with other humans is one of the greatest possible joys in all of human life. And your sister, Juliana, also sings. Does she play?
Mm-hmm. She plays a few different instruments. She's not a professional musician. She knew pretty early on that that wasn't really what she wanted, but she's an amazing musician. She's kind of dabbled in a lot of instruments over the years. She played fiddle. She actually played fiddle before I did. Acoustic guitar, electric bass. I gave her a couple clawhammer banjo lessons a couple years ago, and she picked it up, like, insanely fast. So she's becoming pretty good on the banjo. But she's mainly a singer. She's a super amazing singer. She was, like, the musical director of an a cappella group in college. And
wow.
Lots of good stuff. Yeah, she writes songs. She's awesome.
Sounds like you guys are very close.
We are. We're best buds.
That's great. What was it like for you to have a sibling that was also musical and somebody else to sing with? And what's different about singing with family versus other people?
Totally. I think that, like, my sister and my mom and I, and my dad too, we all really love singing together. And there is definitely a pretty special thing that happens when, especially I think the three women of the family sing together. But it's really interesting because, like, even though we do have a lot of, like, shared musical experiences, my sister's voice and my voice developed in pretty different directions because, like, I went pretty far in the, like, folk direction, and she was always really into, like, pop music and musical theater and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's funny, like, I think our singing styles are pretty different, but if you hear us talk, like, people say all the time that they can't tell us apart on the phone. But yeah, our singing styles have evolved in really different ways. But I think just because we have, you know, a certain, like, there's a certain crazy, freaky sibling connection. We're able to blend really well when we sing together. And it's, yeah, there is totally a special family thing.
I mentioned this earlier, but your parents are music educators, and they would go to Maine Fiddle Camp where they would teach there. Mm-hmm. But you didn't want to go because you thought playing music was for old people. You said, yep. I liked it, but I didn't really see a place for myself in that. I just associated it with my parents' generation. I'm interested in like how you relate to representation. It totally resonates with me that you didn't think playing folk music was for you because you didn't see people that looked like you playing it.
Yeah, totally.
What has been your experience with identity and representation like that?
It's something I think about all the time. It's just impossible to overestimate the importance of representation in music and in all other areas. It's been studied that people feel more inclined to do something when they see someone who looks like them or who shares a certain identity or experience with them excelling in that area. I mean, I've seen that come up in so many ways throughout my life. I think the first thing was just like seeing young people in folk music. That was, you know, that was a really big turning point for me when I started seeing young people playing folk music. That was when I wanted to be part of that community myself on my own terms. And, you know, of course, this isn't something I have personal experience with, but you see it a lot with people of color in the folk world. In the last, you know, half century or whatever, like, folk music has been perceived as a very white-dominated, it is a white-dominated area. A lot of people don't realize that that's very contrary to where folk music actually comes from. And there are so many amazing people now who are sort of reclaiming that heritage and making it visible again as it rightfully should be. I was just watching my friend Jake Blunt do a live stream for his new album, which is focused on his interpretations of the Black string band tradition. You know, I admire people like Jake and Rhiannon Giddens so much for doing that. But my personal experience with representation has been, I've had a lot of really gratifying experiences where I feel like I've been able to kind of, you know, be the role model that I didn't always have. It's insanely humbling and gratifying that I could be that for someone else. I've had gals come up to me and say, like, I've never seen a woman play guitar like that before. And I'm not, like, an amazing guitarist. Like, I'm good, but, like, you know, it's just, like, the bar is so low sometimes. It's really wild. I recently produced an album for Liv Green, and that was my first time acting as the producer. And, you know, obviously women producers are perhaps even more underrepresented than women guitarists. And I'm glad to just be a small drop in the bucket towards, you know, changing the balance.
Camp was also the first time you saw young people innovating with their own musical ideas within a traditional music framework, which is like basically what Lulu Wiles' whole thing is.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what that realization was like for you as a young musician and why that practice is so important?
Yeah. I think there's this weird thing that happens in the folk music world where people forget that innovation is literally what folk music is about. I see it perhaps most starkly in the bluegrass world, where people just get so hung up on playing things exactly the way that Earl Scruggs or Bill Monroe played them. And it's like, you know that Earl Scruggs and Bill Monroe were inventing a new style of music, right? Like, the tradition will die if you don't innovate with it, if you don't keep moving it forward, because that is perhaps truer to the actual spirit of the tradition. I think preservation is important too. I think it has to be both. And that isn't to say that, like, you know, all old people are trapped in the past and all young people are the forward-thinking innovators. There's a lot of great music all across that spectrum being made by people of all different ages. But I do think having age diversity in the traditional music world is a big part of keeping it, you know, feeling alive. And so when I went to Maine Fiddle Camp and met, you know, young musicians who loved like pop music and rock music and also loved traditional fiddle tunes. And you could hear that, you know, in their music, in the way they played and sang, and in the songs they were writing. That just made me feel like, oh, there's a way to combine all the different elements of my musical identity. It doesn't have to feel incongruous. It doesn't have to feel like you can't meld these things together.
There are no rules.
There are no rules. You can literally do whatever you want.
Eleanor Buckland was on Basic Folk a while ago, and we talked about, like, I don't really understand the culture of these old Maine fiddle tunes. There's mm-hmm. like a legacy.
Yeah.
Like I read somewhere, you're like, Lissa Schneckenberger, who's this like amazing young fiddle player.
Yeah.
She taught us an old logging ballad. And I'm like, what the hell is that? what did you learn about, like, when learning these fiddle tunes? You must have learned the history about them. Mm-hmm. But like, also, what did you learn about how fiddle helped people express their Maine identity?
So if you look at any like regional music tradition, you will see that a lot of traditional music serves very practical functions in people's day-to-day lives. You know, there's an amazing musician who I know from Maine Fiddle Camp. And there's a ton of people in Maine doing this, but this guy, Bennett Kinesny, was the first person who really got me hip to the concept of work songs. And there's, you know, logging ballads are a good example of this. Like, there were these songs that people would sing both to, like, document what their work was like, and also songs that people would sing while working. You know, you hear those like sea shanties. A lot of those people would sing while they were working on ships when they had to do work kind of in tandem that involved like pulling ropes and things. I don't really know how it works. I've never worked on a ship. I don't know really what it's about. But I know that there are situations where you have to perform certain physical actions in tandem with each other. And so people would sing to kind of keep a rhythm while they were working. You hear that in field songs. People sing while they're working in the fields to kind of like keep their spirits up, but also to like keep a rhythm with what they're doing with their hands and their bodies. And that is so cool to me that music can serve that function too. And a lot of fiddle tunes, most fiddle tunes are dance tunes, you know, back before people had all of the modern varieties of entertainment that we had now, they would go to dances. And that was where people would meet up with their communities and hang out and have fun. And that's what a lot of those fiddle tunes were for. There's a really great community of preserving those traditions in Maine. And Maine Fiddle Camp is a big part of that. And I feel so lucky to know about it. It's such a cool little corner of the world. But it's also like, this is what everyone's life used to be like. I think it's cool that there are people who are so dedicated to keeping those traditions alive.
So you met Molly Obomsawin and Eleanor Buckland, who are your bandmates, in Lula Wiles at Fiddle Camp when you guys were like 10, 11, 12, little peanuts. So on top of meeting young people who play folk music, what was it like to connect with them?
It was really cool. It was really cool. I kind of became friends with Ellie before I became friends with Molly. And Ellie and I met in Lissa Schneckenberger's fiddle class. And two of the things that initially brought us together were we had the same favorite fiddle tune. Lissa went around the class and had everyone say what their favorite fiddle tune was. And Ellie and I both said Hull's Reel at the time. Which I think we both learned off the Hallali record by Laura Cortese, Lissa Schneckenberger, and Hanukkah Castle. A big influence on both of us. And the other thing was Harry Potter. I remember us having a very intense discussion about Harry Potter because I think one of the last Harry Potter books had just come out that summer. Fiddle Camp was such a great place to develop as a young musician because it's also like, it's also just summer camp, you know, like we had all these opportunities to just like run around and be young little mischievous kiddos and, you know, swim in the lake that is now more of a bog and you know, sneak out of our cabins at night and sing songs around the campfire and play fiddle tunes. And it was just a really, like, organic atmosphere for, like, building those kinds of musical friendships. The first time that me and Ellie and Molly ever performed together was at Maine Fiddle Camp. It was the three of us and my friend Lena Tullgren, who is, Lena and I grew up together, and they're now, like, an amazing indie rock singer-songwriter. So it was just, like, a really great environment to get started in. And it's, like, totally not surprising to me at all when I think about, like, what that environment was like. It's like, oh yeah, of course I started a band with people that I met there, because we had this amazing foundation to build.
I think you like this story too, the story of Molly's first memory of you talking to her. Do you want to tell the story?
So according to Molly, we were in the lunch line at Maine Fiddle Camp. And I was, like, a few people ahead of Molly in line. And she was talking to one of her other friends about the, like, big group sing around the campfire the previous night. And she was saying, like, oh, I can't sing. And apparently I just turned around to her and I said, shut up, you can sing. Which is, like, such a fucking me thing to say.
Yeah, like, I want to...
So snarky, yet also encouraging.
Yeah, I was, like, wondering, because you were like, I don't remember it, but it totally sounds like something I would say. What do you think that memory says about you?
I think that memory is, like, weirdly prophetic about, like, me and Molly's friendship, that just, like, we can be super, like, snippy and snarky with each other, but fundamentally very supportive and encouraging. I think that, like, I do really want to encourage other musicians, especially, you know, other women. And I do really feel that, like, that anyone can be a musician if they want to. So I think, you know, me just being like, shut up, you can sing, was like, it was just like kind of like a stereotypically sort of obnoxious way for me to phrase it. But, you know, coming from a place of, like, wanting to encourage someone else to believe that they could make music.
One more question about Maine Fiddle Camp. Mm-hmm. You said there's a spirit there where you're just making music that feels good to you, not music that you think will sell a lot of records. So being in Lula Wiles, a touring professional, NPR-loved band, there can be a lot of pressure to, like, sell and market yourself. But how do you work to maintain that Maine Fiddle Camp spirit?
That's awesome. That's a great question. I think a lot of it is about making music that feels right to us and true to what we want to express. And that's part of why I feel so grateful that we have been able to partner with Smithsonian Folkways as our record label, because they are a nonprofit. And I think that ethos, they're really about making music that is expressive and that represents various voices of various people, is huge. And, you know, not that there are, like, there are great for-profit record labels out there. But I think that, you know, as a band with pretty strong, like, anti-capitalist community-based values, I just feel so lucky that we have a record label whose number one goal is not making money. And I think we're all pretty, like, you know, we take our, like, artistic integrity pretty seriously, and
I can tell just by the
you know,
way you
yeah
said
we
that.
All want to make music yeah we all want to make music that feels, like, honest and expressive and authentic and whatever those things mean. Hard to define them, but I don't really care how many albums we sell if I don't love my own songs. Mm. You know,
in thinking about your lead guitar playing, I was wondering, mm-hmm. like, because it sounds like you were like, wouldn't it be funny if I took a guitar solo, and then you didn't know how to, you didn't know how to solo, but then you just, like, started doing it and, you know, practiced and got better and better. But, like, what does that say about you as a musician? I'll tell you how I see it, and you can tell me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, tell me.
I see it as, like, another example of how you're, like, a pretty brave performer.
I thank you for saying that. That's really nice. Yeah, I think that, I don't know that I would say brave necessarily, but like maybe confident. If other people think I'm brave, I'll take it. That's great. But a lot of it is, you know, I had a lot of support early on, you know, I wish that for everyone. And I, you know, I was already kind of starting to improvise on the fiddle, so I wasn't coming into it totally blind on the guitar. Like, I kind of had some general ideas about how to improvise, but I, like, physically didn't really know what I was doing on the guitar. But, like, it was just when I started playing with Ellie, we started playing as a duo, and usually it was, like, one of us played guitar and one of us played fiddle, and then sometimes we started doing some two guitar stuff, and I was like, haha, it would be funny if I tried to take a guitar solo. And then I just, you know, I did it more and more and started getting good at it. And I think also a big part of that is, like, women tend to feel more confident when they're playing with other women. I think that's why women often tend to start bands with each other, because there isn't that weird kind of like gender dynamic thing where like all the guys have grown up seeing men shredding the guitar, and so they've felt confident like working on that from a really young age, and that is often not the case with women. So like I experienced this so much at Berklee, where like my Harmony 4 class, I was the only girl.
Oh, that's a high level, Harmony 4.
Yeah, it was the highest level. And I was the only girl in the class, and I just felt like so, I felt so scared a lot of the time that if I said something wrong, everyone else in the room would be like, oh yeah, of course the girl got it wrong. You know, and I would just feel this need to prove myself all the time. And you don't feel that when you're playing music with other women. You can just like, you can try things and get it wrong and experiment and learn without worrying about whether you're like doing a good job of representing the team. And I think that plays out across so many different like identity groups, that people of any marginalized identity group feel like they need to be extraordinary. They need to like represent the team as well as they possibly can. And that's a really kind of unfair standard to have.
I've read a little bit about how like the complicated feelings that you have about like dressing up on stage and like just kind of like looking the way that you want, like, what, you should just be able to wear a sweatshirt on stage, but then women have to like wear makeup and dresses and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that is a debate that will never end.
Yeah.
But in totally. Thinking about how you look while performing, like the way that your band Lula Wiles dresses on stage actually speaks more than just like women looking good on stage. Like, I see it as women dressing modern and hip in the same way that like you're modernizing the folk genre, like continuing on what Aoife O'Donovan, Laura Cortese, Hanneke Castle, Lisha Schneckenberger, like those ladies, like were, I mean, Laura Cortese changed my life with fashion. Like, we used to go shopping together, and like,
that's her, awesome.
Seeing her perform on stage in these like incredibly modern outfits while playing like a fiddle tune, I was just wow, like this is like really something. I think I just want to know how you feel about that, like what intentionality do you see with Lula Wiles, like
image? Oh man, this is something that I think about a lot, and that we've talked about a lot as a band. And I was having a conversation with my parents about it recently. My dad was sort of asking me about it, because, you know, my dad is a feminist man, and he wants to think critically about these things, which is great. It's really complicated. I've had some really good conversations with Molly specifically about this. Both of us sometimes feel like we don't want to dress super feminine on stage. Like, I feel like there was a time when I was always wearing like floral print dresses and stuff like that. And now I don't really like wearing dresses or skirts on stage most of the time. I prefer pants or perhaps a nice jumpsuit from time to time. But then we're also like, fuck man, like why do we feel that way? Does something feel like mismatched about a woman in a floral print dress, like, stepping on guitar pedals? Do you feel like you can't shred a solo in a floral print dress? Or does that really feel like, oh no, I just want to dress this way because it feels more true to me? I will never know the answer to that question. Because, like, there's, you know, there's no control group. You can't really, like, look at your own ideas about, like, gender in a vacuum, because a society, a non-sexist society, doesn't exist. So, like, I don't know what it is. And I just try to keep interrogating those things within myself, because, like, I like to look good on stage. I do sometimes wish that, you know, we didn't have to, but it sort of feels like, you know, you're putting on your armor. You're getting into, like, it helps me get in the zone when I feel like I'm wearing something that makes me feel, like, powerful. Do I feel like I have to wear pants and I can't dress feminine in order to be powerful? I don't know. And, like, obviously pants can be feminine too. You know, there's so much to it. And it's so complicated. I try to find, like, a nice balance and really figure out, like, which things are for me and which things are, you know, which things I can reject because it just feels like I'm adhering to the societal pressure. Like, I've decided I like wearing makeup, but I usually don't like shaving.
Right.
Makeup I do for me. Shaving I was doing because I felt like I had to. And so I'm just mostly not doing that anymore.
Right.
Are you good at
listening to yourself when your subconscious is like, Issa, I don't like this floral print?
Yeah, I think I'm getting better at it. And I think it's also, like, I'm trying to ask myself, like, why don't I like this? Like, do I really want to wear makeup for me? Or do I want to wear it because, like, society rewards me for wearing it? And, like, also, you just have to, like, be a person. Sometimes you just can't, like, you can't just, like, do the progressive thing 150% of the time. Sometimes you're like, yeah, like, I don't want someone to tell me I look tired, so I'm gonna wear makeup.
Love that. It's my favorite thing. Somebody says that.
Oh my God.
We're going out with a bang here. I wanted to talk to you about body image stuff.
Woo!
We talked about this off air for a couple of seconds, and you introduced the idea of body neutrality to me, and I've been thinking about it, like, ever since. And I wondered if you could talk about the evolution, if you're comfortable, talk about the evolution of your relationship with your body. And how do you think the body you have shaped, like, you as a human?
Oh, boy. What a massive and fascinating question. I'm so glad you brought up the concept of body neutrality. I somehow came across an article about this concept. I think it was in Man Repeller. That was talking about the concept of body neutrality. Man Repeller is an amazing website. Focusing on fashion, but also other things. And I didn't really realize until I read this article, I didn't really realize why, like, body positivity had kind of rubbed me the wrong way sometimes. I think it's a great concept, but, like, what body neutrality means to me is, like, you don't always have to feel positive about your body. Like, we can just not worry so much about bodies all the time. And that, like, attractiveness and, like, fitting into, you know, fitting into someone else's ideas about, like, how your body should be shaped and what size it should be is just, like, it doesn't have to be the thing we all think about all the time. And you don't have to feel positive about your body in order to, like, be good at what you do or be valued. As someone who performs on stage for a living, or did until recently, it is unfortunately something you have to think about. Like, I have had so many experiences where, like, I'll see a photo of myself taken in the middle of a show, and I'm like, oh my God, no. And that's such a shitty feeling, because It shouldn't be about how you look. But it is, because people look at you for your job.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm not a small woman. and I'm someone who is... I'm medium-sized. I can find clothes that fit on my body in most stores.
Mm.
It just blows my mind that, like, I feel like I have such a complicated relationship with my body, and yet there are women who are bigger than me, you know, who can't find clothes that fit them in most stores, and I'm like, fuck, I feel like it's hard for me. It's so much harder for them. So I do want to, like, acknowledge that. My bandmates are both smaller than me, and not that, you know, thin women can't have body image issues too, but I just think it's like, it's just fucking true that, like, the bigger you are, the harder it is. Mm-hmm. There have been times when, like, we go shopping at vintage stores when we're on tour, and I'm just like, yeah, I'm just gonna wait over here. This store has nothing for me. Mm. And I also have, like, pretty big boobs, and that makes it hard to shop.
Do you remember that store at the mall that was like 5'7" 9"? Where, like,
no.
Everything was like a size 5, 7, or 9.
That's so dumb. Well, now there's that stupid store, Brandy Melville, where everything only comes in one size, and it's supposed to be one size fits most. I want to fucking burn that store to the ground. I hate it. It's like, are you trying to give people eating disorders? Like, stop.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to see bodies as neutral. And I think that if you have big boobs, your body tends to be sexualized. Like, you know, I remember, like, when I was in high school, like, being told that, like, what I was wearing was inappropriate because you could see that I had big boobs. And I was like, look, my body is shaped like this 24/7. You know, like... I'm not, like, there's nothing inherently sexual about a body, and there's nothing inherently good or bad about having a body of any size. And that's a hard thing to learn. Like, I try to do a lot of, like, thought experiments with myself when I'm, like, when I'm thinking about any kind of bias that I might have. Like, if you were told there's this great music producer, you know, this person is, like, a genius in their field. It doesn't even have to be a music producer. It could be, like, a neurosurgeon or whatever. If you're like, this person is a genius. They're so smart. They're so good at what they do. They're so accomplished. And then the person who walks out is, like, a fat black woman. Are you surprised? You know? Like, I try to ask myself questions like that all the time to just sort of really, like, dig into, like, where I might still have biases. The thing that I always come back to is, like, we all have biases, and those don't exist because we're bad people. Like, we all grew up in a society that taught us to think this way. It's just, like, baked into everything, into, mm-hmm. like, advertisements and movies and TV. And so we all have to kind of, like, deprogram our brains a little bit. And, like, that's the part that's our responsibility, but, like, the bias is, it's in the water. You can't avoid it, and it isn't your fault. What is your fault is, like, if you don't do anything about it. And I think my mom really raised me to be skeptical of advertisements in all ways. Mm. I think that was really helpful for me in trying to develop, like, a healthy body image, and also just developing my general, like, anti-capitalist sentiments. And my mom was like, she wanted us to, like, not watch TV with advertisements in it for a long time. And, you know, obviously when I was a kid, that was annoying because I wanted to watch, like, Nickelodeon, like all my friends. And she wanted us to just watch PBS. but as an adult, I'm really grateful for that because I think it did help develop a lot of my attitudes about those things.
Man, I will say that...
I have so much more I could say on this.
I know.
But yeah, keep going.
We'll have to do another podcast specifically about this. Yeah, because
I have
my own opinions and feelings. It's hard to, like, find somebody to, like, talk about this with, because mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of my approach to this for my life has been like, I just want to be like, oh, I'm so fat. And then I just want someone to be like, no, you're not. But, like, mm-hmm. really what I wanted somebody would to say was like, it doesn't matter. You're still a good person and we love you.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. And like, that is like right on. And like, I think I want people to be able to talk about bodies in a way that doesn't have to be sexual and doesn't have to be negative. Like, I can just be like, yeah, like, I'm a little chubby. Like, I have a belly that hangs out a little bit. And, like, who fucking cares? Who cares? I remember I was thinking about the movie School of Rock. And there's a weirdly, like, super body positive scene in that movie where, like, Jack Black plays the music teacher. And there's a young black girl named Tamika who wants to sing in the band, and she's a really good singer. And she says to him that, like, she doesn't want to sing in the show. And he says, why? And she says, I don't know, because I'm fat. And he doesn't say, you're not fat. He says, who cares? He was like, you know, when I get up on stage, people love me because I'm sexy and chubby. Have you ever heard of Aretha Franklin? Like, she's a big lady and people love her. I can basically, like, recite this movie verbatim because I've seen it so many times. It was, like, my favorite movie. And I just remember watching that and being like, man, that's so cool. And, you know, if you look at the history of music, there have been so many, like, amazing big women who, like, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, she's, like, a big black woman who was, like, one of the first rock and roll guitarists. She was super, super influential, and a lot of people don't know about her. I think she was queer, too, which is, like, she's just the coolest. Yeah, and so, yeah, God, amazing. Yeah, and so, like, it's such a pervasive bias that still exists among people, and you know, just gotta, like, not be afraid to dig into it.
Yeah, I agree.
It's just really great to talk to people about it, because I feel like I've had so many conversations with people about this where both of us are just like, yeah, oh my God, like, we can talk about this. Right. Oh my God, yes, I experienced that too.
Yeah.
And people just feel so much shame.
There's so many topics like this in life that are, like, so taboo.
Mm-hmm.
Hearing about people who have miscarriages and then them talking to other people who have had miscarriages, because it feels like you're the only person in the world that's ever experienced anything like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think maybe the lesson here, Issa, is if we've learned anything in our conversation, is to talk about things that are uncomfortable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think so.
Just throw it out there.
Yeah.
But not with everyone.
Not with everyone. Some people just can't handle it.
Right. Right.
And, well, and, you know, try to create safe spaces for talking about these things.
Totally. What we're going to do now, Issa, is something called the lightning round.
Ooh, fun.
Okay. Here we go.
Lightning round.
First song you learned on the guitar.
Day Tripper by the Beatles.
Batman or Superman?
Batman.
Karaoke song.
Complicated by Avril Lavigne.
Favorite radio station as a kid?
92.5 The River.
In Massachusetts?
Yeah, we got it. I was in very southern Maine. We got that station. Yeah.
Nice. Dogs or cats or something else?
Cats, but I don't subscribe to the dog-cat binary.
Love that. Me neither.
But if I had to pick,
you've passed.
Cats. Yeah.
What is your coffee order?
Cold brew, black.
Hardcore. Favorite U.S. city?
Brooklyn? Brooklyn, New York / South Berwick, Maine. I don't know.
First album you bought with your own money?
Metamorphosis by Hilary Duff. It's just the truth.
First concert?
I have no idea. Probably one of my parents' concerts.
Last book you read?
I'm currently reading Pleasure Activism by Adrienne Marie Brown. Before that, I read The Secret History by Donna Tartt, which is amazing. Both of those books, amazing.
Ooh. Dream collaboration?
Ooh, I would love to work with Sam Amidon.
Flying or invisibility?
Flying.
Star Trek or Star Wars?
I guess Star Wars, but I don't really have a strong opinion on that.
Lord of the Rings or Narnia?
Lord of the Rings.
Where's the most beautiful place you've ever visited?
Probably Florence, Italy.
Nice.
Yeah.
Is that the Celtic part of Italy?
Not to my knowledge.
To ask your dad.
Yeah.
Issa Burke, thank
Although
you so
mom
much.
My mom would be the Italy expert.
Oh,
in
all right.
The family.
Well,
yeah.
You'd check with Susie.
Yeah, I will. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to our producers, Laura McCarthy and Adam Corey. Basic Vote produced by Laura this week. Also, thanks to our business manager, Lindsay Myers. Alex Stanton of Townspeople does our music. Basic Folk is proudly part of the American Songwriter Podcast Network. You can find all sorts of show notes and details at my website, including links to Issa and her Patreon. My website is cindyhouse.net. I hope you liked what you heard, and if you did like what you heard and you're listening all the way to the end, you must really like this podcast, and in which case I'd appreciate it if you would tell a friend or subscribe, rate, and review, and we'll talk to you next time. Okay, bye.